How can you better support your patient's brain health? Tune into our FX Medicine Perspectives Forum, a live panel discussion packed with clinical pearls on hormones, movement, the gut-brain axis, and more. Watch the recording by logging into bioceuticals.com.au/education and walk away with practical insights you can use in clinic right away.
Welcome to FX Medicine, bringing you the latest in evidence-based, integrative, functional, and complementary medicine. I'm Dr. Michelle Woolhouse. FX Medicine acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia, where we live and work, and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to the elders, past and present, and extend this respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today. Today we're going to explore the role and use of personalised digital technology, in particular continuous glucose monitoring, also known as CGM. I want to explore how we use this technology in non-diabetic patients as a way of supporting behaviour and lifestyle medicine changes in issues such as weight management, metabolic syndrome and polycystic ovarian syndrome. So joining us today is Jessica Turton. Jessica is an accredited practicing dietitian. She's the director of Ellipse Health in Sydney and is soon to finish her PhD at the University of Sydney, where she's looking at the evidence for low carbohydrate diets and ketosis in the treatment of diabetes and obesity. Welcome to FX Medicine, Jessica. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Pleasure. So I'm going to start off really simply and just ask and tell our listeners, what is CGM?
Well, CGM stands for continuous blood glucose monitoring. And it's basically a little device that you wear on your body, and it's monitoring your blood glucose levels without you having to think about it. There's a little tag that's inserted just under the skin. It's completely painless. It sounds a little bit invasive when you're first explaining it to someone, but it's painless. And you're just wearing this technology and it's taking your blood glucose readings. And then what you need to do is you need to upload those readings onto some sort of cloud system or your phone or whatever it may be so you can actually view them. And what you get to see is a picture of your blood glucose readings over the course of the day. So it might be, you know, while you're asleep, in between meals, after you've had something to eat, during, after exercise, I mean, during work meetings. There's so many different factors that impact your blood sugar levels. And so it's really, really useful to actually wear one of these monitors and learn more about how food and non-food factors impact your individual blood glucose levels. And we all have sugar in our blood. That's very, very important. Our body needs to, I guess, maintain quite a tight range of sugar in our blood or glucose in our blood in order for all our cells to function properly and for our brain to function properly and our organs and so on. There's lots of different reasons why you might use one of these devices.
We're going to go into sort of how we can use them differently, because currently really they're used and they've been a game changer for the management of insulin-dependent diabetes. And so in your clinic, you're starting to use CGM as a way of looking at other aspects, so not so much about insulin-dependent diabetics, but, you know, maybe, yes, if you've got that condition, but also broadening the use of CGM. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I guess I'm doing both. So for my PhD is focused in type 1 diabetes, so very much using these glucose monitors for people with type 1 taking insulin. And, yes, it's an absolute game changer for people taking insulin, because we know that insulin can change your blood sugars very, very drastically. So it's very important to see and monitor what they're doing if you're going to take a medication like insulin. But outside of my PhD, in my clinical practice, in my sort of day-to-day work, I don't have a huge amount of patients with type 1 diabetes, more so just because type 1 diabetes isn't super prevalent. And I do see people with type 2 diabetes or people who are just trying to lose weight or people with the metabolic syndrome, people with PCOS. And we work with Dr. Pran Yoganathan at the Center for Gastrointestinal Health. So a lot of our patients have chronic gut issues as well. And yeah, we use CGMs in many cases for those people too, because what we know is that most chronic diseases are associated with inflammation in one way or another. And your blood glucose levels are also associated with inflammation. Mm. So yeah, we know that if your blood sugars are too high for too long, that literally causes inflammation. And we also know that if your blood sugars are rapidly changing, that is another thing that can cause inflammation. But you can also see the impact of inflammation on your blood sugar levels too. So it's kind of a chicken or egg situation. Mm. Let's say somebody has, you know, a really stressful meeting or they're, you know, have really bad sleep because they're in chronic pain. Their body will make more stress hormones and that will actually cause an increase in blood glucose. So you get to see sort of like a cause and effect of inflammation and stress.
That's so brilliant. And I want to go into kind of the nitty gritty and the details of that because I'm super interested in that. But because like in clinic, previous to something like using a CGM, we used to use things like hemoglobin A1C or fasting glucose, maybe cholesterol, maybe uric acid to kind of look at glucose metabolism as a whole. And there's so many limitations to those tests because they're really just a snapshot. So as I was preparing for this chat, there was a research paper discussing, you know, three different patients all with the same hemoglobin A1C, but they all had three different types of glucose curves. One with super high regular, you know, regular highs and regular lows, which therefore the averaged out the hemoglobin A1C was normal. Minimum variation, so obviously that's the optimal, and then intermittent excursions, so slow rises, slow declines. So this is the kind of variation that CGMs can pick up, am I right?
Yeah, definitely, because the CGMs, depending on which one you're using, they're either taking a measurement every 5 minutes or they're taking a measurement every 15 minutes.
Right.
So you get to see the curves of the blood glucose across the day within an hour. You get so much data within 1 hour. Whereas, yes, the HbA1c, what that is measuring how much sugar has kind of stuck to your red blood cells. And we sort of call it a 3-month average of your blood sugars. So it absolutely can't capture day-to-day variation.
That's right. And so tell us a little bit about glucose dysregulation, because in clinical practice, that's actually quite a new way of expressing glucose dysregulation, so the variability. So I know that in the research they're sort of saying when the blood sugars are too low, that actually creates an adrenaline surge, which then increases your cortisol and then sets off the inflammation cascade. What's happening with these high readings and too low readings?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing I sort of thought about when I started using these CGMs is, far out, we actually don't know what normal blood sugars look like, because CGMs were, or they've always been used in people with type 2 diabetes or insulin-dependent diabetes, type 1 diabetes. So we started off using these devices in people with severe blood glucose dysregulation.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and it's only, I guess, more recently that people are accessing them for other reasons. And even the research looking at people without diabetes and using glucose monitors, that's also more recent too. It used to be like, well, if I don't have diabetes, why would I test my blood sugar? You know,
that's
even
right.
The word blood glucose, the first thing people think of is diabetes. But we all have glucose in our blood, and it's important for all of us, right?
So, absolutely. You know, so yeah. What do we know about normal? Like, I mean, I was reading the research and we say, you know, a sugar as high as 11 postprandially is okay. Is that okay? Or should we be trying to gain tighter control? What's your experience in practice?
So most of the blood glucose targets, usually the targets for fasting blood sugars and after meals are usually 3.9 to 10. And if you're measuring it directly after a meal, as you just said, oftentimes it goes up to 12. But in my opinion, they are for people with diabetes. So those broad ranges, those management targets that you usually find online or you even find on your glucose monitor, they are generally for people who already have established diabetes, and we're just trying to prevent their diabetes from getting worse. That's what those targets do. Because you can have somebody with type 2 diabetes, for example, who is within the range of 3.9 to 10, 100% of the time, but their blood sugars are all over the place. They're feeling terrible. Their HbA1c might be 8 or 9, and they're on, you know, tons of medications to try and control their blood sugars. So those ranges definitely aren't what we would call ideal. What we do know is that a blood sugar around 5 is where our body does function at its best.
Yep.
And of course, there's going to be deviations sort of above and below that. So in our clinic, we tend to recommend a range of sort of 3.5 to 6.5 as where we want our blood sugars to be for the majority of the time. But even with that range, we still want to, I guess, wear a glucose monitor and actually see where the blood sugar is sitting and for how long. Because, you know, we do have some patients that always sit between 3.5 and 6.5, which is pretty tight blood sugar control. But there'll be some days where their blood sugars are just hanging out at 6 all day. And we're like, well, hang on a second. Why is your blood sugar sitting too high at 6? On this day, and then all the other days it's at 5. We know, because we have the glucose monitor, we can collect all this data, that that 6 is abnormal for that person, whereas another person, their blood sugar sitting at 6 could be normal for them. So, yeah, there's individual variation and we don't have the exact answer, but these glucose monitors allow practitioners to learn from their patients. And, yeah, you collect so much data, you ask the patient how they're feeling and things like that, and you can kind of figure out what their ideal blood sugar range is.
Yeah, and I think it's just fascinating too of the kind of, you know, you mentioned the chicken or the egg kind of factor, because it could be they might be at 6 because they've had a really poor night's sleep or there's something bothering them. So I always love looking at, I guess, that internal stress response. You know, some people cope with stress so beautifully, but somewhere in them there is still stress, even though they might be coping, you know, really well with it, or it could be the sleep or the alcohol the night before, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So it's a great way of exploring what actually is going on for that individual person.
We have picked up so many cases of sleep apnea by putting glucose monitors on people.
Yeah, that's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, really fascinating. I mean, I thought GPs were doing quite regular testing for sleep apnea, and perhaps they are, and perhaps the patient just doesn't want to go off and do that sleep study because I imagine that's pretty uncomfortable. But yeah, you're exactly right. If their blood sugars are sitting too high overnight, and in some cases we see people's blood sugars like swing wildly up and down through the night, and we're like, did you get up and have something to eat? And they're like, no, I was asleep this whole time. And then we say, well, how did you feel when you woke up in the morning? Terrible. I felt like I hadn't slept or I'd been hit by a truck. And it's like, okay, you need to go and investigate that because that is definitely not normal.
Yeah. Well, sleep apnea is so prevalent, really. I mean, you know, they're sort of saying 10 to 15% of the population, and the sleep study places are so full, you know. Sleep physicians, the wait's, you know, 3 to 6 months. So that's often, you know, some of the issues that GPs are facing as well. So, but apart from dietary choices, let's talk about these other factors that impact glucose modulation. So we mentioned sleep, and sleep apnea is a big one, but also anxiety, for example, affects glucose modulation, and exercise. Let's talk about what other impacts that you've seen using CGM apart from their dietary choices.
So these non-diet factors are more clear in people that do have some level of insulin resistance, like the metabolic syndrome or pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes, polycystic ovarian syndrome, because the process is still happening for people without diabetes, but you just don't see it as clearly on the glucose monitor. And again, depending which glucose monitor you've chosen, it might be really quite sensitive. It might not be that sensitive. So, for example, if you are, you know, doing some exercise, and let's say you're doing exercise that requires glucose. So if you're doing a high intensity interval training session or something like that, even if you haven't eaten any carbohydrate, your body still needs glucose for that activity. So your body will make glucose for the activity. And you will generally see within a sort of 15-minute period, your blood sugar rise because of that, because your body has made the sugar. And then what tends to happen is, because your muscles are pumping and working really hard, the muscles will just suck up that glucose without your body needing to produce insulin. So you can see that on a blood glucose monitor. As I said, you can see it more in people who are a bit insulin resistant, because their muscles are a bit insulin resistant. But you can still see it if you've got an athlete who's training really hard, then they're making lots of glucose. You can see that.
And when you say, you know, showing lots of glucose, are we talking kind of up around the 7 or 8, 10 or 11? Like, what are the numbers that you kind of see when you see someone that is just doing a high-intensity workout?
It depends where the blood sugar levels start. Right. So, like, let's say they're doing like a fasted activity and they haven't eaten anything for 12 hours, so their blood sugars might be just hanging out on the lower end, maybe around 4, 4.5. Then if they do a high intensity interval session, their blood sugars might go up to like 6.5 or something like that. They're not going to go super, super high. But the other thing as well is, it depends on which blood sugar monitor you're using. If you're using a blood sugar monitor that's taking a reading every 5 minutes, you might actually pick up that it goes even higher. If you're only using one that takes a measurement every 15 minutes, you might miss a data point that goes even higher than that. So you might not actually see how high it goes, but it's still a good indication of how your blood sugar is changing. And it's not a bad thing. You know, like, patients will come in and they'll be like, oh my God, exercise is terrible for me. And they'll show me all their spikes from exercise. And when I say spikes, again, it's relative to the individual. So they might be like, you know, really, really setting out to have these stable blood sugars. So if they see a little spike like that, it's something that alerts them. Yeah. And we just have to understand that it's different for exercise, high intensity interval training, because your muscles are sucking up the glucose. So you're not producing insulin in those situations. Whereas stress is different, because stress, we are producing all these stress hormones, which increase our blood glucose levels in expectation that we're going to need that glucose. But usually, you know, modern day stress, we're sitting at a computer screen wondering why our emails aren't working or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. IT so stress.
Yeah, exactly. So we don't tend to actually use that glucose that our body made, and it kind of just sits in the bloodstream, and then our body has to put it away. And the way our body puts it away is by producing insulin, and then that helps the blood sugar go into the cells. And if you're doing that a lot, if your body's always producing insulin throughout the day because you've got a lot of stress going on, that can lead to weight gain, insulin resistance, progress you towards diabetes and high blood pressure and things like that.
Yeah, amazing. So what about hypoglycemia? So sometimes when I've used the CGM in my clinical practice, there's people that actually have hypoglycemic events. They don't actually know that they're having that. Like, they don't actually feel hypoglycemic. But, you know, it's something that is commonly picked up maybe, you know, twice a day, maybe once a day, et cetera. What's going on there?
People without diabetes.
Yeah, people without diabetes. People, maybe they've got some insulin resistance. You know, we're not quite sure. We're sort of just at that early stages.
It depends what it's following. So if you have someone who, you know, maybe they haven't eaten for 4 hours or 5 hours, or they wake up in the morning and they skip breakfast or something like that, so they don't actually have food in their system, then it's probably just that their blood sugar levels are at the lower end of normal. Because when you say hypoglycemic, what numbers are you talking about?
Oh, 3.4 sort of thing. Not in the twos, but just in the low threes.
So what I guess
the question is also like, you know, it's the same with blood pressure. We have these arbitrary cutoffs, like anything below, you know, 150 is low blood pressure. But some people, you know, walk around with 90 on 50, but it's normal for them. Yeah. So I guess that's the thing is like, you know, we've got this 3.5 to 6.5 is normal. Is some people normal at 3.4, 3.3?
Yeah, definitely. So people who are, if their body can use fat efficiently as a fuel source, then the blood sugars will sort of drop because their body doesn't need the glucose. Mm. So say for, like, as I was saying, like if you haven't eaten for a while, if your insulin levels are low, so there's nothing stopping you from burning fat, your body starts breaking down fat, whether it's stored body fat or fat from the diet, and using that for energy. Your brain will suck up that fat. Your heart will suck up that fat. Everything in your body will be happily using fat. Mm. And glucose's role is to provide us with energy. So if your cells are already taken care of and they're using fat, they don't need as much glucose. So your body will naturally produce less glucose. But it's never going to just stop producing glucose. Like if you don't eat carbohydrates for 48 hours, your body is still going to make the glucose you need. It's never just randomly, like your blood sugars aren't just randomly going to fall to one or anything like that. You know, some people get a bit alarmed if they see their blood sugars going low. It just means your body doesn't need as much glucose at that time.
Yeah.
Now, that's for someone who's not symptomatic. If you're actually symptomatic and you're, you know, feeling symptoms of low blood sugar, so you're shaky or anxious or hungry or irritable, usually in someone without diabetes, that usually follows a meal. And it might be 1 to 2 hours after a meal. And what it means is that it's something called reactive hypoglycemia, where it's a form of carbohydrate intolerance, where your body actually overpredicts how much insulin you need. So when your blood sugars start rising because you've eaten some carbohydrates, like let's say you've had a meal with mashed potato or you've had some bread or something like that.
Mashed potato is terrible, isn't it? It's like really, it's really like a bowl of Skittles.
Well, look, any carbohydrate is going to lead your blood sugars to rise, whether it's good carbohydrate, not good carbohydrate. I mean, that's carbohydrate breaks down to sugar, so it has to cause an increase in your blood sugars. But, yeah, with some people, their body really doesn't like their blood sugar changing. And so when the blood sugar starts to rise, their body will release large amounts of insulin, probably more insulin than they actually needed, which can cause a consequent drop in their blood sugars. And because their blood sugars are dropping too low for their needs, what happens is they tend to feel symptomatic, they run out of energy, they get brain fog, shaky, irritable, and so on. But eventually what will happen is their stress hormones kick in, like you were alluding to before, and they'll start making glucose again. So it's not a life-threatening situation for people without diabetes, but it's certainly something that can make people feel uncomfortable, can increase anxiety, can make it very, very difficult to, quote-unquote, eat healthily. These people do need quite a specific diet where the carbohydrates are controlled. They have a lot of protein, good healthy fats, and that basically stabilizes the blood sugar.
Yeah. Because it's interesting when I was doing some reading up on that, and because one of the issues with hypoglycemia and the way that the body responds, you know, you mentioned the release of stress hormones, but that release of stress hormones also actually activates cytokine release and increases platelet activation and neutrophil production, which can then also microscopically lead to this subacute inflammation that we all talk about in terms of one of the drivers of chronic diseases. So I think it's one of those things that if this is a big issue, this is the sort of stuff that CGM, you know, is a game changer for, one of the things that we can kind of look out for. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, definitely, for sure. Mm. And I always recommend patients when they're using a CGM to keep as many notes as possible. The CGM usually stays on for 7 to 14 days, depending on the brand that you get. And, yeah, usually it pairs with an app on your phone. And every time you scan your phone against the sensor, it gives you an opportunity to write a note. So, I would always recommend take down notes about how you're feeling. So any symptoms that are slightly unusual, headaches, irritability, anxiety, any stressful events, any physical activity, and then, of course, food as well.
Mm. And you mentioned sleep apnea before and kind of diagnosing sleep apnea. Is there other aspects of glucose dysregulation that actually affects insomnia? So, for example, like a lot of people, you know, they may not have sleep apnea and they actually feel like they do sleep. But we know a lot of people, I think it's up to 33% of the population, suffer some level of insomnia. In your experience, has glucose metabolism or dysregulation play a role in that?
Yeah, I would probably say there's quite a few mechanisms for why it would. But one thing that I'm just thinking for people who, this would be people with diabetes and without. But a big issue that we see for people with insomnia is magnesium deficiency. Mm. And we know that when your blood sugars are high, what happens is, I don't want to get this wrong, but it's either your glucose and magnesium compete to get into the cell. So if your blood sugar's high, glucose will preferentially get into the cell over magnesium. Mm-hmm. And then also when your body is excreting glucose from the body. So if your blood sugars are high and you have excess blood sugars, your body tries to get rid of that to bring it back down to normal. So you'll lose glucose in the urine, for example. But to get that glucose out of the body, it does take magnesium with it. Mm.
So it's like a magnesium wasting. Yeah, we waste our magnesium. Yeah.
So we know that people with glucose dysregulation and insulin resistance, they have a higher requirement for magnesium. Mm. So they're more likely to become magnesium deficient. And if you're magnesium deficient, then your cells, including your muscles, your nerves, they're not getting the magnesium they need. And they need magnesium to switch off and relax. So a lot of the times people are going to bed and they're wired, you know, that wired but tired feeling. Yeah. And it's like whatever they try to do, they can't, you know, they can't switch off, they can't relax. You know, they don't even yawn because their body just can't get into that state of relaxation.
Yeah,
and it's such a good magnesium.
Yeah, it's such a good way to understand it too, because I've often spoken about, you know, magnesium, you know, when you do have a high, you know, carbohydrate diet, or if you have a lot of coffee, or if you have a lot of alcohol, or if you have a lot of stress, you waste that magnesium away. And so, you know, it's just a really nice, simple way for people to understand, you know, why do I need so much magnesium, which to kind of calm myself down.
So I know.
It's that trying to block up the holes, trying to block up the loss of the magnesium, which is really common in our day-to-day lives.
Exactly. And my patients will always say to me, what did humans do 10,000 years ago when we didn't have all these supplements? And I'm like, well, they certainly weren't experiencing this chronic stress like we are today. So their requirements for these nutrients weren't as high. And then the other thing about magnesium, which you've probably talked about before, is that the magnesium in the soils in Australia is so deplete. So the foods that we used to think were rich in magnesium, like berries and nuts and seeds and things like that, they no longer contain sufficient levels of magnesium. Mm. So our food isn't a reliable source. So most people are going to need a supplement even just to meet their basic requirements, let alone people who are under significant stress, which is most people. They're definitely going to need a level of supplementation.
Brilliant. I 100% concur. But I wanted to explore a little bit because, you know, we mentioned high intensity exercise, which is obviously, you know, the latest and thought to be really fantastic for weight management and for many people an exercise of choice. But what about different choices of exercise? Like, do you know, or do we know about things like long walks? You know, Hippocrates always talks about, you know, walking is man's best medicine, you know, like that kind of 10,000 steps a day, or do we know the impact of something like yoga on glucose metabolism? So, you know, do we know a little bit about what particular exercise and how it changes in terms of glucose metabolism?
Well, I mean, I can tell you what I know from my patients. I would say to my patients, coming from where we were speaking about before about stress, is choose the exercise that lowers your stress the most, because generally what happens is you've got people who want to lose weight, right? So you've got people who are desperately trying to lose weight. They're on all these crazy diets, they're fasting, they're working 10 hours a day, and then they're going to the gym for like 2 hours doing everything they can. there's a lot of patients that fit into that camp that are just desperately trying to do everything. Mm. And for those people, if you've got this heightened level of stress, you'll probably find in your glucose data that your blood sugars are just sitting a little bit too high all day. So when you come along to that exercise, if you're then doing something like high intensity interval training, it can actually cause more harm than good in some situations, because exercise is a stressor. It's a positive stressor, but it is still a stressor. And so I like to think of our stressors all going in the same bucket. It doesn't matter whether it's positive or negative. So if you've got all this negative stress going on and then you're trying to be healthy, and one of those things is adding lots of exercise, especially that high intensity interval training, which is probably one of the more stressful forms of training for your body, then it actually may not be the right thing for you. And you may notice in your blood sugars, they sit a little bit higher, and or they don't come down as quickly as you'd like after exercise or something like that. And for those people, maybe doing a half an hour walk would be better. And we might work on the stress in the body. So we might increase their magnesium, increase their omega-3. We might change the structure of their diet to stabilize their blood sugars. And once we've done all that and their body is under less stress, then they can go and do the HIIT training, because their body is able to deal with the stresses better because they don't have all this stress overflowing their stress bucket.
Yeah, that's such a good way to look at it, so that people can actually start to choose and see and witness, you know, let's get that biofeedback from their own choices. Amazing.
Exactly. And I don't know, I mean, that's probably more something you'll see in people's symptoms rather than using a blood glucose monitor per se, because you know, if you talk to a patient and you hear they're doing all this exercise, they might be doing 1.5 hours a day and they're trying to lose weight. So you're kind of thinking, oh, good for them, that's great. But then you dive a little bit deeper and find out that they're not recovering after exercise. So they're sore for like 7 days instead of just the next day. And when they finish a session, they feel more fatigued, not more energetic. If you're noticing things like this, they're getting a lot of muscle cramps, muscle pain, things like that, then it probably means that the exercise is too inflammatory for them. So they need to change the type of exercise or reduce the duration.
And what about things like, you know, alcohol, smoking, some of the more illicit drug-related activities? What do you notice with that? Is there research on things like smoking and glucose?
I don't know about smoking in particular, but I do know about alcohol. And alcohol is a good one to talk about, because alcohol can actually lower your blood glucose. And so a lot of the times, especially people with diabetes, their blood sugars are sitting a little bit high and they have a couple of glasses of wine or they have some spirits or something like that, and they see their blood sugars come down and they're like, oh, this is the best thing ever. I should just drink everything tonight.
Great.
It's a good one to talk about. And then in your people who maybe don't have high blood sugars, or even people with type 1 diabetes, then having alcohol can actually make your blood sugars go too low. So again, it's something to be aware of. And the reason that this happens, and I'm talking about pure alcohol, like dry wine or spirits that don't have any carbohydrates or sugars in them.
Sure.
So what happens is, if we think about the different fuel sources for the body, we've got fats, we've got carbohydrates, and we also have alcohol. And your body can only use one source of fuel at a time. It cannot metabolize two at once. So your body will always prioritize the most toxic fuel first. So usually that's glucose. Your body will always burn glucose before fat. If you eat like a sandwich or something like that, like a cheese sandwich, your body will always deal with the glucose first. The fat usually just goes and sits on the sideline. Usually it never gets burned for most people because the body's always dealing with the glucose.
Right.
And that's really important, because if your body didn't prioritize the most toxic fuel first, then that glucose would just sit in your blood and start damaging things, because it is toxic. It is a toxin. But alcohol is more toxic than glucose. So again, your body needs to prioritize the alcohol first, which means glucose needs to sit on the sideline. And so your body's in a tricky situation there, because glucose is also toxic. So what your body does is it stops producing glucose. So your liver's production of glucose, which is always going 24/7 in the background, it just shuts off.
Right.
So what that does then is it causes the blood glucose levels to kind of dip lower. And they tend not to just like drop. I mean, they definitely don't just drop to nothing. Your body still maintains a safe level of blood sugar control if you don't have type 1 diabetes. But they do drop significantly. So as I said, people with type 2 that are used to having blood sugars of 10 all day, they might have some alcohol and their blood sugars drop to 8 and they're in the green zone and they're like, this is cool, I need to drink more alcohol. Yes.
Yeah. That's usually really fascinating. I mean, there goes that's why fatty liver and alcohol-related fatty liver is the two sources of metabolic syndrome within the liver.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And I think if people are having one or two drinks and the drinks aren't associated with extra sugars or extra carbohydrate and it's part of a healthy diet, then I don't really see any detrimental impact on that. I mean, if you already have established fatty liver or something like that, then you might want to reconsider. But for people who don't, it's usually not detrimental. However, what tends to happen when people drink is they make poorer choices. So they either drink more, they're like, oh, I'll just have one or two, but then it leads to 3, 4, or 5. Or they choose foods that are less ideal for them because they've got, you know, less awareness and less worries, I guess. So it's kind of
less
like
frontal lobe, less inhibitions.
Decision-making capacity, yeah.
Yeah.
So I usually try to figure that out with my patients too. Like if they're having one or two drinks and that's not leading to any consequences, then that's no problem at all. But if one or two drinks leads to a whole, you know, path of other issues that can then negatively impact their blood sugars and their health, then it's something you need to look at.
Yeah, it's just brilliant. I mean, it's just, it's such a great way to explore metabolism, lifestyle, stresses. What is the feedback that you're getting from patients? Yeah, what are they saying about using a CGM? Are they finding it helpful? What are they saying?
It's a good question because nowadays that is the main reason we use it, just so the patient can see what's going on. Because we've used so many, I have so much CGM data that I can in many cases predict what someone's blood sugars are going to be doing based on everything else they've said. You know, I almost don't need to do the CGM for a lot of people anymore, unless it's like a troubleshooting exercise, you know, where we've done everything else we can and we really just want to check the blood sugars are all good. But yeah, most of the time we're using the CGM for their benefit so they can see on a day-to-day basis how different foods and different activities are impacting them. Because in our education session, we might say, okay, these foods that are high in carbohydrate are going to increase your blood sugar and that's going to cause a release of insulin and that's going to, you know, potentially stop you from losing weight. And it's one thing to hear that, but then it's another thing to actually see it firsthand in your own blood glucose. And especially for patients who are a little bit resistant to change. So we have some patients who come in because their doctor told them to, and they're not really that keen on changing their diet. They think everything they're doing is right. Maybe they've been following standard conventional healthy eating advice, but they've got type 2 diabetes or they've got high blood pressure or the metabolic syndrome. And we try to give them this new education and we try to tell them, well, hang on a second, what you've been doing isn't working for you. They may not actually believe what we say, but then taking a blood sugar monitor and testing their blood sugars, we might give them a target to aim for and they're seeing that every time they eat a meal, they're constantly out of target. And then they're coming back for their second session and now they're engaged and now they're really keen to learn because, yeah, seeing it firsthand in your own body is amazing. I mean, it's the best way to learn. And it's the best way to troubleshoot for yourself. Like oftentimes you don't need to give patients all the information, just give them a glucose monitor. And oftentimes they can figure it out for themselves.
Yeah. I mean, it's potentially game changing. I think this kind of personalized insight-based data. I mean, the internet, as we know, last, 15 years has just flooded us with knowledge and the knowledge isn't enough to get us kind of motivated in many ways. I mean, obviously for some, sure it is, but for other people, it's like, I just need to know what's right for me. And I think the CGM, you know, monitoring is actually like, okay, well, let's show you what's right for you. Let's see it. Let's witness it. Let's look at your choices and let's see whether we can kind of ascertain how you're actually doing and how you want to do in the future. So I just think from a behavior change perspective, you know, those daily insights, you know, 15 minutes or 5 minutes, whatever the increments are, is just such a powerful way for people to actually investigate their own choices and do what they need to kind of do. Jessica, thank you so much for being with us today to discuss this new technology and particularly how it can be utilised in clinic. I just love, you know, that in-depth understanding of the highs and lows. It's like being on a seesaw of glucose, food choices, exercise as well. And, you know, metabolic health optimization is probably one of the most critical aspects of world health today, you know, and the work that you're doing in your PhD is so vital to understand, you know, metabolic dysfunction and what we actually need to do as clinicians to change this very, very scary trajectory of human health. So I'm excited to watch this space with you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. No, it's a pleasure to be here. And maybe next time we can talk about glucose data for people with type 2 diabetes and with type 1 diabetes, because that's, you know, that's a whole other conversation to have. That's still very, very important.
Yeah, let's do that. That's a date. We'll pop it in the diary.
Let's lock it in. Sounds good. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, everyone, for listening today. Don't forget that you can find all the show notes, transcripts, and other resources from today's episode on the FX Medicine website. I'm Dr. Michelle Woolhouse, and thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
This podcast is intended as healthcare practitioner education only, and it is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to FX Medicine. And share us with your family, friends, and colleagues.